I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more fascinating, thought-provoking, and insightful books of the season is the latest from the journalist Susan Delacourt. In Shopping for Votes, How Politicians Choose Us and We Choose Them, we're given a thorough look at marketing in Canadian politics. What we see is how marketers have pervaded the political arena, creating an industry for themselves, how politicians utilize their handiwork, and how the population generally reacts to them. In the last 50 years or so, more and more public service has turned into products, citizens, into mere voters and taxpayers, while ideas seem to mean nothing more than policy proposals whittled down to mere talking points. I'll get Ms. Delacourt, who joins me now, to talk about this book, her findings, what prompted this study, as well as the latest from Ottawa, what with the Senate troubles and more. Susan Delacourt is an award-winning journalist and a senior political writer at the Toronto Star, formerly with the Globe and Mail and the National Post. She's written three other books, United We Fall, Shaughnessy, and Juggernaut, which is a great book. This book, which is just remarkable, is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant on the Land program in Ottawa this day, Susan Delacourt. Ms. Delacourt, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
And thanks for the kind words.
You're very welcome. So everyone's talking about what's going on in Ottawa the last week or so in the Senate. Has this really been as historic as some have suggested it is?
Well, I've been here a long time, as you alluded to, and I've seen sort of uproarious adventures like this before. I think we're still waiting for this to play itself out. I think we have to wait and see how much Canadians are seized with the drama here. And the problem with this one is that it's like an octopus. It has a lot of arms. Figuring out where it's going to go, where it is, it's hard also to compare it to other problems before because it's got so many different players, and the story keeps changing sort of day in, day out. So I know it sounds like I should be able to speak with authority on this one, but I have to confess that each day brings a new surprise.
And so do you have a sense of how the public feels about this and perhaps how this all ends?
No, I don't. I've been watching the political shows today. I've been sort of trying to listen to to turn off the noise here and listen to what's happening outside the Ottawa bubble. And I think the public is getting a series of confused messages. One is, why shouldn't Mike Duffy and Pamela Wallin lose their jobs? That's what would happen in the private sector. So if you're comparing this to some office dispute, or some have compared it to a high school dispute, it seems that nobody's covered in glory. What's a harder message to get out there, and this is addressed in the book, there's a nice segue for you,
yeah,
is the idea that the public seems to have lost the sense of the idea of the Parliament of Canada and the political theater as a court, as a very high court, where the top court in the land, really. And the idea of things here resembling what would happen in a court of law is increasingly, people just see that as apples and oranges. When I first got to Ottawa, there were a lot more lawyers in the actual House of Commons. The place functioned more as a legal forum, where there was the one side of the house was the defense and the other side was the prosecution, and you assumed that the truth would come through. But as I say in the preface to my book, that metaphor seems to have been lost in the last 15 or so years. And now it's more the idea that whoever has the sharpest marketing slogan and the snazziest way of talking to voters as though they are purchasers of politics rather than witnesses or judges, that those people are the ones who are most successful.
And so why has that happened? Is it because someone figured out, well, if we do it this way, we can win votes and win elections, and really that's what politics is all about?
Well, I think this is an oversimplification, but consumer is a way that politics has come to describing people who don't care about politics anymore. That it is complicated. The world is very complicated, and political problems are very complicated. And who has the time to sit and sift through that? I think the last big exercise we had in this in Canada, and a story I covered a lot, was the Constitution, when you could actually get people arguing over fine points of constitutional law. And it is almost like the country collectively, the politicians and the voters alike, said, okay, we're done with that now. That's it, right? That was just too dramatic, too bruising. So let's just make things simple now.
And I guess, as you said, we're too busy. So when we see an ad in the middle of, say, the sporting event we're watching or the reality show that we're watching, that really helps us decide who to vote for at election time.
I think this is something that we in the media are reluctant to acknowledge, and probably out of self-preservation. But I think the last election sealed this reality in all of our minds. An ad is going to be more powerful than anything that is stated in the media.
Yeah.
That it's not that people have turned off the media. It's, as you say, a lot of them don't watch the news. I think you see in the book how the conservatives have done some very careful digging into media consumption habits and found out that probably only half the population watches the news. So if you want to reach them, you put ads in sporting events or primetime sitcoms or dramas, because that's where people are getting their information. So we saw in the last election campaign that a lot of people believe Michael Ignatieff was American. The ads never said that, but they implied it. And you didn't see that fact in the media. You saw it in advertising. So in a world where voters are consumers, advertising is the means of communication.
And politicians are using this to their advantage and turning, say, the voter, the so-called voter, against you people in your profession in the media, sort of saying that the big bad media doesn't get you,
mm-hmm.
or they're not reporting what the facts are, even though... I mean, we saw that during the prorogation thing in when was that, 05? One forgets now.
It's 08.
Yeah, 08, sorry.
Well, no, there have been a few. So.
Yeah, and
08 and 09.
Yeah, the conservatives would say something in the press, and you guys in the media would sort of scramble and have to decide whether we actually correct them.
Yeah, the coalition
yeah.
crisis is another example I can think of where, you know, some blatant mistruths about constitutional government were being put out, but what was said in the media, you needed to go through the fine points of it. The big example I use, and
yeah.
I don't use this in the book, but I have been, I think you want to see the most stark evidence of this reality is talk about Bev Oda, the former Minister of International Cooperation.
Yeah.
She did two very bad things in her parliamentary career. One, she lied to Parliament and was in contempt of it, which helped provoke the 2011 election. She got her job back after that, and she the Conservatives were reelected with a majority. Then Bev Oda charged $16 for orange juice on a foreign trip, and she was gone. So Bev Oda paid the price for being a very bad consumer, a very bad buyer of orange juice. She did not pay the price for being a very bad parliamentarian. And I think that tells you all you need to know about the public's appetite or tolerance for complicated arguments and ones in which simple paying too much for orange juice is a bigger crime than contempt of parliament.
The in the book you talk about how the political arena has turned into a marketplace, and that it really is just transactional politics now, that we as citizens expect something for our tax dollar, and I guess the governments of the day react to that by giving us stuff that we want to hear, and the biggest example, I guess the recent example, is the throne speech. I mean, as a political reporter, this is obviously the trend. Is that a good thing?
First of all, I'm going to be sending the government, when they're through this, they're just otherwise distracted right now, but I do intend to send them a thank you card for helping me prove my point with that throne speech for consumers. The idea that we are mere consumers of government and that the only thing we have to do is shopping is, I think, I don't actually believe that the public is that way. I'm even after 25 years here, I'm still a bit of a political romantic, and I think there is an appetite for people to hear more. I just think there's an element of almost defeatism in the idea that all the public wants are discounts on their taxes. The big example is the GST, and the Conservatives knew that it was not a great idea for the fiscal health of the country. Every economist in the country told them, you do that, you'll be in the red. Yet, the quickest way to reach voters, they thought, was at the cash register with a discount on their taxes. And it's the evolution of the GST is really the evolution of how far we've gone down this road. Back in, it's not that long ago, I still remember it, 1990, Prime Minister Brian Mulroney thought that he could bring in something that wasn't necessarily going to make people happy, but he thought that they would understand, that people understood that there were bigger things than just paying a price at the cash register. Jean Chrétien thought that he could spin it a little better. He could solve it with advertising. And as the book points out, marketing, in the strict definition, is changing your product to suit the public. And Stephen Harper applied some marketing to the GST, which was change the product to suit the public. Don't try to sell it, in other words. Don't try to spin it in different ways. It actually changed the GST and your principles and the best ideas about it and the, you know, the sober second thoughts about GST to make it more palatable to people at the cash register.
Well, we've also seen, and you highlight this in the book throughout, is how marketing. I mean, marketing has sort of been in politics for forever, mm-hmm. but in the last 50 years or so, how it's changed from gearing certain messages to certain regions. So this is so-called winnable ridings that Keith Davey used to talk about during the Trudeau years, and then targeting specific ridings and now specific segments of the population.
The way I put it in the book is winnable ridings to winnable people.
Yeah.
And when Keith Davey first, and the Liberals back in the 60s, decided that there was such a thing as winnable ridings. I think people forget this. A lot of people were scandalized by it.
Yeah.
Politics is supposed to treat all voters as equal. And the idea that the Liberals would spend more time and attention on certain ridings was it just seemed like everything that was wrong with politics back then. Now, because we have more data, because of technology, because things have just got more sophisticated, now we can get political strategists deciding winnable people, that they can actually target the neighborhoods they want, the very neighborhoods that will change their votes or vote according to, you know, the latest thing they heard. So we saw in the Conservatives found out somehow in their research that people who own snowmobiles were likely to vote conservative. So they buy up the lists of magazine subscriptions to snowmobile magazines, find out where they live, and then you see in government these strange press releases, we get, you know, hundreds a day, announcing snowmobile grooming, government spending money on snowmobile grooming in such and such a riding, and that's because of their market research into the voters. The New Democrats wanted to put out a consumer-friendly message in the last few years, especially under Jack Layton, and they found out that they bought data to find out where people were paying the highest cell phone bills so that they could put a little postcard through the door and tell people that Jack Layton would reduce their cell phone bills. This is the most visible manifestation of how sophisticated things have got and how much the politicians, what lengths they're willing to go to talk to voters as shoppers.
You mentioned how the Conservatives use this or use these tactics in the NDP now. The Liberals, are they in a position where they have been using this sort of data mining and the sort?
A little bit. They're way, way behind horribly behind, actually. And some of that is just because they got complacent in power. They didn't pay attention to what was happening. You know, when you're number two, you try harder. And a lot of this started back at the turn of the century. It was really around 2000. It started in the States, this data mining and big data. The conservatives were first. The New Democrats have been trying to catch up. And the liberals seem to be, for some reason, well, two reasons, as I'll say. One is they just got complacent in power, and they were busy fighting each other in leadership battles, et cetera, et cetera. The other reason is, and I have Justin Trudeau in the book talking about this, this liberals really believe, are really mass marketers still in terms of politics. They don't like the idea of targeting, of vote targeting. It's a very hard thing for them to decide that somebody is an accessible voter, which means you have to decide that some people are inaccessible. There's a great anecdote one of their guys who's building the database told me, is that they've got this really fancy, snazzy technology that will show which houses in a certain riding. They don't have to bother knocking on the door because that vote, you know, it's lost to them. And when they buy it from the States, it's because they're registered voters in the United States and they know which doors to go to and not to. Anyway, they can't persuade liberal canvassers to ignore certain houses because liberals believe that anybody could vote for the liberals. You know, there aren't votes that are excluded to them. So it's part of it, this is a long way of saying, part of this is dispositional, and part of this is just being way behind, complacency.
Well, one of the interesting things in the book is how much of an industry marketing and communications has become in Ottawa.
Yes, there are way more people. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but there are a lot more communications and marketing experts, people who actually title marketing in their, the word marketing in their job titles, then there are policy people now in the Prime Minister's office and the Privy Council office.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost horrifying in a way. are these tactics, though? I mean, they seem to be working for a political party in that they're in power. But at the end of the day, are they turning off voters, do you think?
Yeah, I think that the irony, as I say in the book, is that the more that they've gone looking for voters this way, the more they're turning them off. That's what makes me believe that there is an appetite out there for people to have a conversation wider than just their shopping concerns. I think this is why you see young people deciding to get interested in NGOs or foreign or work abroad, is that there is an appetite for people to be part of something bigger than themselves. And the way I've maybe oversimplified it is to say consumers have wants and citizens have needs. Consumers think in the short term, citizens think in the long term. And we all know that we can't live our lives only thinking about our wants and in the short term. And similarly, I don't think our politics can exist on that too. The problem is those conversations are tough to have. It's tough to have a conversation about increasing taxes. It's in fact, you get laughed at now in politics at the mere suggestion that you would do anything that would cost people money. But there is a bigger conversation to be had, and it's whether any politician is brave enough to have it.
So how do we have that conversation, and do you really think that if we brought ideas back into the marketplace, if you will, that would stimulate voter participation, citizen engagement?
Well, I have to get out of bed every morning and go to work on the Hill, so I have to believe that. the reason I wrote this book, one of them, was I don't propose any solutions, though I think there are some things we should do in the short term. Like, I think we've got to have some rules around advertising in these databases that we don't have right now in politics. I think that it is right now the Wild West out there, in that's not a geographical slur in Canada, it is the historical one. I just think that the politicians have functioned way too long trying to pretend they were not businesses, and yet using all the tools that businesses have with none of the rules that businesses have to conduct themselves. So the first thing I would do is acknowledge this. I just would like people to realize that they're being spoken to this way, that they're being, that this is the way they're being cast in the political play, and maybe just demand a bit better, you know, demand more.
So you are hopeful?
I am.
Yeah.
I am. Several of my colleagues have read the book and said that they found it utterly depressing. And I didn't mean to depress them, because I do think the first step in fixing the problem is just acknowledging it.
So if you read the book, you sort of get a sense of what the 12 cans on the front of the book, what that's all about. Did you design the cover, or was that someone that...
No, I didn't. I'm sure I'm not the only author. They just send you the cover design. You know, and it arrived by email, and I was so delighted. I was so surprised and delighted with it I don't actually know who did the design, because it was quite a while ago. The design is taken is a reference to Martin Goldfarb.
Yeah.
The legendary liberal pollster in the 1970s. And this was a great day when I found the article. Actually, the Stars Library found it for me. And Martin Goldfarb, in around 1970, 1971, was giving an interview in which he was not even called a pollster yet. That was not a word in Canada. He was a sociologist who was working with politicians. And he was conducting what he called things that they called then sensitivity sessions, which we now call focus groups. And he was doing the same work for the private, he's an anthropologist, he was doing the same work for the private sector, going out there and, you know, finding out what people were thinking, and then passing this along to the politicians. In this article, he was explaining that he was doing work for Ontario Premier Bill Davis, a Conservative, and some other politicians. He hadn't yet become the Federal Liberal Party pollster, but he said that he could sell politicians like you sell cans of tomatoes on a shelf. And at that point, the politicians were horrified. Bill Davis called him up and said, "Tomatoes, really?" And Pierre Trudeau was not impressed with it. Martin Goldfarb had to get over that tomato thing when he signed up to be Trudeau's pollster. Cast ahead 40 years, and you don't hear politicians arguing about the comparison to being cans of tomatoes anymore.
Yeah.
Most of them don't complain anymore.
Yeah. This is such a great book, and having followed you on Facebook and Twitter, I understand that it was a bit of a struggle to get it out.
Yeah.
Because your former publisher had some trouble, but now it's out, and you're happy with the responses that you're getting, right?
Yeah, I think... I've been really happy with the responses from people who say, "Now I get it." What I basically wanted to do, so many political books are stories about people, you know, that, and I've done a few of them myself, and I wanted to tell a story instead about an idea, and I wanted it to be a story. So it goes from, as you point out, from the Second World War to now, and just traces the evolution of a story, and less your listeners think that it's a boring insider's tale or a depressing one. There's lots of fun stuff in there. I had a lot of fun finding out the ways in which the things that we were seeing in the stores all these last half century or so were finding their way into politics, whether it was jingles and customer testimonials in the 1950s and 60s, brands and generic and niche products in the 1980s, to databases and data mining now. But all of these things that have fed the shopping world have had an influence in politics in ways that I think people will, they don't have to be even creeped out about it. I think some of them are just amusing.
Are you a Mad Men fan?
You know, I have not watched much of Mad Men. I should, as everybody keeps telling me, but I've only seen the first season.
Yeah. See, I was going to ask you who your favorite character is, because I've heard you refer to Mad Men in interviews that you've done, and so I thought...
Yeah, no, I don't have a favorite. I can't say I've watched it that much.
Yeah.
I have a favorite Mad Men character from the book, is Terry O'Malley, the guy who did all of my most fun few days in researching this book. We're going to Brock University,
uh-huh.
and going through the incredible archives of Terry O'Malley, who was the creative director of Vickers and Benson, and did all the advertising for Trudeau and for Loblaws and some of the big companies back then, and beer companies, and Vickers and Benson was in charge of the 72, all the advertising for the 72 Canada-Russia hockey series. His archives are a national treasure, and the man himself is just a delight. And so, yeah, that was definitely a fun few days. If I had to go back, and you could spend weeks going through his files, because he was a pack rat. So
yeah.
When they Trudeau would come, or Trudeau's people would come and ask them to do an ad campaign, Terry kept notes, and they're all in this archive. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's the other great thing about this book, is we get to meet people like O'Malley and get to re-meet people like Dalton Camp and Ellen Gregg. Get to
all
know
great people.
Yeah, and then even people like Frank Luntz get to know what he's doing,
yep.
or Gordon Reese in Britain.
Yep.
This is such a terrific book, and I've long been an admirer of your work, so thanks for this.
Well, thank you for asking.
The book is called Shopping for Votes, How Politicians Choose Us and We Choose Them. It's from Douglas and McIntyre, the Toronto Star, Susan Delacourt. Join me on the line from Ottawa in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.